We're exploring three books in the Bible known as the wisdom literature: Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job. And they're all asking the question, what does it mean to live well in this world?
So we've looked at Proverbs, who you could think of as a bright young teacher.
She's all about pursuing wisdom, an attribute of God that's woven into reality. And she's optimistic that if you use wisdom, you will build a successful life.
But then we come to Ecclesiastes, who's more like this sharp, middle-aged critic. And he says,
"You think using wisdom will bring you success. You'd better think again, because life here under the sun is meaningless."
And that's a phrase he uses a lot in this book.
But to understand this book, we have to realize first that we're hearing two voices.
So first there's the teacher, and we've been calling him the critic. He's the main voice in the book.
But he is introduced to us by another figure, the author. And he's the one who's collected the critic's words, and then at the end of the book summarizes everything and gets the final word.
So why does the author want us to hear from the critic?
Well, he wants to turn your view of the world upside down, and he's going to let the critic explore three really disturbing things about the world.
And we should warn you, these are pretty intense.
Yeah. So the first is the march of time, or as the critic says,
"Generations come and generations go, but the earth, it's been here long before us and will be long after. No one remembers people from long ago, and all the people yet to come, they too will be forgotten by those who come after them."
So, on a cosmic scale, you and I, we are just a blip. Stars are born, and then they die and form planets which orbit new stars, and those planets, they change over time and eventually burn up.
And amidst this cosmic backdrop, my entire existence is like a blink in time.
Which leads to the critic's second disturbing observation, that we are all going to die.
"Humans face the same fate as the animals, death. All people, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, those who offer sacrifices to God and those who do not, they all share the same destiny. All this activity and madness, then we all join the dead."
Man, this book is depressing.
And so is the final disturbing thing for the critic, and that is life's random nature.
So in Proverbs, life isn't random. There's a clear cause and effect relationship between doing the right thing and being rewarded.
But the fact is that life doesn't always work that way. The critic has observed a glitch in the system. He calls it chance, or in his words,
"The race doesn't always go to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food always come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the educated. Time and chance happen to them all."
So his point is that you can't really control anything in life. It's just way too unpredictable.
So if I want to master life,
then you're setting yourself up for a fall. Now, throughout the book, the critic uses a metaphor to tie together all of these disturbing ideas. Nearly 40 times, he says that everything in life is hevel. It's a Hebrew word that means smoke or vapor. Like smoke, life is beautiful and mysterious.
It takes one shape, and before you know it, it takes a new shape.
And smoke looks solid, but try and grab it, it'll slip right through your fingers.
And when you're stuck in the thick of it, like fog, it's impossible to see clearly.
Now, our modern translations have lost the metaphor, and they usually translate hevel as meaningless. But if you read closely, the critic isn't saying that life has no meaning, but rather that its meaning is never clear. Like smoke, life is confusing, it's disorienting and uncontrollable.
So, what are we supposed to do with all of this?
Well, surprisingly, the critic first of all acknowledges the perspective of Proverbs. He says it's a really good idea to learn wisdom and to live in the fear of the Lord.
Really? I mean, he just said that doesn't guarantee success.
But he knows it's the right thing to do. But secondly, and more often, he says that since you can't control your life, you should stop trying. Learn to hold things with an open hand, because you really only have control over one thing, and that's your attitude towards the present moment. Stop worrying, he says, and choose to enjoy a good conversation with a friend, or the sun on your face, or a good meal with people that you care about.
The simple things in life.
Yes, and both the good things and the bad, because both are rich gifts from God. And that's the surprising wisdom of Ecclesiastes.
Listening to the critic is painful and can lead you into some dark places.
And that's why the author speaks up at the end of the book. He doesn't want you to lose hope. He wants to make you humble into someone who trusts that life has meaning even when you can't make sense of it, that one day God will clear the heaven and bring his justice on all that we've done. And so he tells us that the proper response to all of this is to fear the Lord and keep his commandments.
And that's the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, there's one more voice in the Bible's wisdom literature, and that's the book of Job.
And he will bring us the final, much-needed perspective on our journey into wisdom.
Honored to serve as pastor here. I also get the thrill of sharing the main message each week. And we're going to look at Ecclesiastes, as you saw so clearly in this video. So we're going to walk through this book of Ecclesiastes in light of the book, the books of wisdom that we're sifting through together. And the idea here, of course, is that when you come to faith in the Christian faith and you put your trust in Jesus, he makes you alive. You leave death and separation, you come alive. And one of the things that you come alive with is wisdom. You come alive with wisdom, along with coming alive with faith, coming along with gratitude. So today we're going to kind of dive into what the book of Ecclesiastes means and walk through what we just saw on video. I doubt that you absorbed everything, but what a great start to see it animated and pictured for us. I have a couple of verses that I picked out that would give you a good cross-section of Ecclesiastes, but instead of cross-section verses, I thought that we'd do the good old-fashioned read a whole chapter together. So let's do that. We're going to be in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and I wanted you to get a feel for how it flows and how this author full of wisdom kind of starts to lay this feel out. It feels like poetry. It feels like somebody being interviewed and sharing their wisdom. But would you look with me at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and we're going to read chapter 1 together. Before we start reading, let me remind you of what we're looking for. Here's what we're going to see in the big idea today. We're going to see that there is a real wisdom. There is a true wisdom, a God's wisdom. And essentially, what God's wisdom means is this. It is the movement away from self-sufficiency and towards full dependence on God. It's described in the book of Proverbs as having a fear of God, and fear means reverence, it means respect, it means submission, surrender, yielding, giving over to. And so we might think of the fear of God as having awe, where it causes us to kind of humble ourselves before the Father. So that's what we're going to look at today, is what is true wisdom and how does that move us away from self-sufficiency? Let's read this together, Ecclesiastes chapter 1. These are the words of the teacher, King David's son, who ruled in Jerusalem. Everything is meaningless, says the teacher, completely meaningless. What do people get for all their hard work under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth never changes. The sun rises and the sun sets, then hurries around to rise again. The wind blows south and then turns north. Around and around it goes, blowing in circles. Rivers run into the sea, but the sea is never full. Then the water returns again to the rivers and flows out again to the sea. Everything is wearisome beyond description. No matter how much we see, we are never satisfied. No matter how much we hear, we're not content. History merely repeats itself. It has all been done before. Nothing under the sun is truly new. Sometimes people say, here is something new, but actually it's old. Nothing is ever truly new. We don't remember what happened in the past, and in the future generations, no one will remember what we are doing now. I, the teacher, was king of Israel, and I lived in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to search for understanding and to explore by wisdom everything being done under heaven. I soon discovered that God has dealt a tragic existence to the human race. I observed everything going on under the sun, and really, it is all meaningless, like chasing the wind. What is wrong cannot be made right. What is missing cannot be recovered. I said to myself, look, I'm wiser than any of the other kings who ruled in Jerusalem before me. I have greater wisdom and knowledge than any of them. So I set out to learn everything from wisdom to madness and folly. But I learned firsthand that pursuing all this is like chasing the wind. The greater my wisdom, the greater my grief. To increase knowledge only increases sorrow. Now, some people say about the Bible, and you've probably heard this, maybe you've said this before, that it's hard to really trust the Bible. It's kind of outdated, antiquated. It doesn't really deal with the modern human condition. It's ancient, it's old-fashioned, and it doesn't really apply. Well, if you know anything about the Bible, you'll learn that in the book of Ecclesiastes, the author himself basically provides for us a manual on all of life. If you add to that the book of Proverbs and the book of Job, you've got every single possible thing, item, circumstance that a human can face, and it's addressed right here in the scriptures, right in the Bible. In fact, it's the author of Ecclesiastes says, I have explored all of life. And then he goes on to describe how he's explored pleasure, he's explored great buildings and gardening and building projects, wealth, music, work, time. He's explored justice and oppression, the problem of death, companionship, friendship, government, and leadership, and on he goes. How impressive is this? Here's what he said. When you think of everything that exists, pleasure, wealth, comfort, he said, there isn't one thing that exists on the planet that I restrain myself from. I've had it all. I've been there already. I've done that already. There is nothing on the planet that I haven't explored or experienced. And then he starts to write to us about what indeed and the way, in fact, that we should see it, how we should understand it. So he offers to the human race an outlook on everything that the human race can experience. And he does so right in this ancient book. Last week, we talked together about the book of Proverbs, and I mentioned to you that there's ways in which people get wisdom, right? They get it by instinct. You're born with this kind of wisdom, which means you're impulsive in your decisions. You do what feels right. You follow your heart. You trust your instincts. Then eventually we grow up, and maybe some of us use observational wisdom, which means we're kind of learning how to do what we're doing in our lives based on the successes and mistakes of other people. We apply it to our lives. Then there's inspirational wisdom, which is I kind of adopt the inspiring parts of wisdom that my family taught me, and I took some of what I learned from my family, and that's how I've implemented decision-making in my family, and so I've grown up now literally by the wisdom of my family, and yet what we discover is that God has given you and me a book of wisdom for us to better understand how to make a good life for ourselves by applying the things he's already given us. We've got the three books of wisdom here with Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job. We've got more books of wisdom than just those three. We've also got the work of God's Spirit to help kind of incline us to do things that are wise for our lives. The scriptures also say you can ask for wisdom and God will divinely reveal wisdom to you by prayer and spending time with and understanding who God is and what he's given to us. These books in the Bible reveal to us the collected wisdom of generations of godly leaders, generations of people. You don't get it out of a textbook. You don't get wisdom by listening to what somebody tells you necessarily. You don't get enough knowledge to make you wise. Instead, God gives it to us through these books of wisdom. What is wisdom? Let's assume we don't exactly know what wisdom is. Wisdom means basically the ability to use intelligence, knowledge, and understanding to make decisions in our lives, to act in such a way that the choices bring prosperity to us or health, or that these choices are beneficial and productive to our life. But when you look at what God says about wisdom, there's a little twist on it, and I want to show it to you and give it to you. Here, let's define it in the Bible. Here's what God says wisdom is in the Bible. It's the ability to see reality the way that God sees it. It's having his view, his vantage point, his understanding of how the world works. And it enables people to apply knowledge in a life that is pleasing to God and brings prosperity to the person. Okay? So this life with God's wisdom is pleasing to the Creator and it brings some abundance in our own life. That's what wisdom means. Doing the right things for the right reasons with the right results based on what we know of God and what he expects. And of course, we know that in the book of Colossians, Paul writes and says, really, the wisdom of God is Jesus. Jesus is the wisest. Jesus gives the most wisdom. He teaches the most wisdom. He actually is the wisdom of God. And if you want to find the ways of God, you follow and know, submit, surrender, and adore Jesus. And in Jesus is the wisdom of God come to life. And he is the way. to life. He is the way to abundant life. And all that's written to us in Colossians chapter 2, 3. So here's what these books basically say to us. Here's the summary. Basically, these three books, Ecclesiastes included, you've got Proverbs, Job, and Ecclesiastes. Here's what they do. They basically explore one basic theme, which is this. What does it look like for humans to live a good life? What does it look like? How to have a good life? And specifically, Proverbs says, if you do the right things will happen. If you make good decisions, you will find that life pays off with good reward. Use God's wisdom and you'll make a good life for yourself. And that's what the brilliant young teacher of Proverbs teaches us. Then we get to Ecclesiastes who says, whoa, wait up. The critic, the skeptical voice of the teacher in Ecclesiastes says, it doesn't always work out that neatly. It doesn't always work out that cut and dry. It reminds me of my dad when he was when he used to kind of follow my Little League career. I like to call it a career. I mean, it was a short career, but it was solid. You know what I mean? And my dad used to yell from the bleachers. And I think the first game my dad missed, I was 38 years old, was a church softball game. And then he gave me some excuse like he was in the ICU or something crazy like that. I said, come on, Dad. Kind of broke your streak, took his badge of streaks away, you know. But anyways, he used to yell from the sidelines. And there's a couple things he would yell. One thing he would always yell is choke up. I don't even know why he would tell me to choke up, but he liked to say that. And the other thing he would say is point your feet. Point your feet. When I'm hitting, he would say point your feet. And what he tried to explain to me was that you could aim the ball. You could aim the ball to right field if you point your feet. You could aim your ball to left field if you point your feet. When you hit it, it'll go in that direction. And actually, I don't know that my dad knew this, but what he was basically saying was true. Closed stance, you can hit it to right field, or if you're right-handed, it's the opposite field. If you turned your feet and pointed them the other direction, you could actually pull the ball and hit it to left field. But here's what I discovered at the wise young age of 12 years old. It didn't really work. I mean, if my dad would have spent more time yelling, swing and miss, he would have been dead on right. Some great coaching, never failed. But he would yell, point your feet. And I discovered at my young age something that was very, very shocking to me is that as much as I tried to do that, it didn't always work, but I also discovered that sometimes it did work. I also know now that the best hitters are able to aim the ball based on how they close their stance or open their stance in some cases. So I learned at a young age that in fact, wisdom works, it normally works, most of the time it works, but there are times that it doesn't work. But the good life that God has promised us isn't guaranteed for all of us all the time. And let me think of it this way. Some of you may know somebody, or maybe this was you. When you came to faith in Jesus, there was a part of you that believed that your life would improve, that the circumstances would get better. In fact, if you lived faithfully devoted to God, you could protect yourselves from trouble. And what a catastrophic discovery to learn that just because you have faith in Jesus, you come to this life of devotion to God, that it is not and no, nor will it ever be a shield to protect yourself from hardship and trouble. This is what we learn. And yet, regularly, I think we bump into people who feel like this. I came to the living Jesus in order to get away from my living hell. I wanted to kind of pick myself up and start again. I wanted to get away from how bad life is in order to come to Jesus, thinking that I'm gonna leave my bad life and join the good life. And how many of you discovered that's not guaranteed? That's not guaranteed. Those problems, those crises, the trauma, the tragedy doesn't necessarily go away. Here's the problem that we're all facing, whether you're a Christian, non-Christian, whether you consider yourself humanistic or you consider yourself a person of faith. Here's the problem we're all facing. Bad things happen to good people who are living wisely in their life. Bad things happen to good people who are living wisely in their life. Even for people who live by God's wisdom, life is random and unpredictable. Even though life doesn't make sense, unfair, and it's absurd, it'll fill us with disappointment, anxiety, and doubt. Ecclesiastes, the book of Ecclesiastes, acknowledges that even for the wisest among us, sometimes life doesn't make sense. Does not provide clarity. Cannot see it clearly. And this is the problem that's addressed here in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now listen, this is far more problematic for us. The idea that God's wisdom in Proverbs doesn't always work. The idea that bad things happen to good people who live wisely for many of us in our lifetime will be catastrophic, that reality. It's not theory. It's not something we agree with. It's something we experience and live. I'm reminded of this every day that I drive on John Glenn Boulevard. There's this sobering, heartbreaking memorial on the one of the lanes off the side of the road, and it's on a tree stump, and it's got some crosses there, and it's a memorial of the day that last year a tree fell and landed on top of a car and killed the passenger. We drove by this last year. I drove on the other side of the John Glenn. I drove past it, and we saw it, and of course, we thought the same thing you did. You know, when you see this, you think, oh, dear God, I hope that isn't what it looks like. It is. Passenger passes away. There's no reports that have been made public that this passenger wasn't wearing a seatbelt. There's no reports made public that the car was speeding or driving recklessly. It's safe to assume that they were driving like the rest of us do, and the rest of us were, with some level of safe wisdom. And an unimaginable tragedy happened that doesn't make any sense. And if you're like me, you've thought probably already, how many split seconds would it have required to be ahead of that tree or behind that tree? And we saw this bridge collapse in Florida, and I think to myself, what are the odds that 4 to 6 or however many cars are under that bridge waiting at the traffic light when it falls? Why can't it fall at night? In my neighborhood, just recently, a reckless, drunk driver in the middle of the night comes through an intersection at 80-something miles an hour in our little suburban neighborhood and absolutely blows up a car full of 3 young people, one of which they were picking up from work, working the late shift, trying to put himself through college, doing the right thing and living wisely, minding their own business. And somebody destroys all of their lives. And I don't even need to tell you that the drunk driver was uninjured. I don't need to tell you that. We have a problem. And I gotta tell you that the Christian faith leaves us the choice to either face our problems or to just fake our way through these unthinkable tragedies and these unthinkable mysteries in our life. And when things don't work out the way you expected, here's what you can do. You have the ability, you have been given the choice to either fake it or face it. And you're a part of a church family based on what we read here in the scriptures and what we know of God. We're not going to fake our way through this question of why do these things happen. We're going to face it. And we're going to face it because we have answers in the books of wisdom. And in the book of wisdom, it says we have the ability to face it. And the alternative is super lame, pretending plastic and fantastic, a plastic smile and a fake handshake to say everything, just like Emmett in the Lego movie, everything is awesome. Everything's cool when you're part of a team. We don't have to do that. We can have joy in our heart that helps us face things, tell the truth about things. We don't have to provide simplistic answers to life's frustrations, to life's unfairness. We don't have to give dishonest explanations about the reality of our life. Instead, we can face it. And with God's wisdom, you can face it with some level of understanding, some level of clarity. And Ecclesiastes is the critic's response to Proverbs, which states that the good life that we want is available when we fear God and when we use his wisdom, and most of the time it works. Some of the time there is unfortunately, doesn't always have a positive result. Sometimes life is hard and troublesome, chaotic, and it defies neat explanations. You're in a church that doesn't provide neat explanations for things that address surface issues rather than really dealing with what's under the surface. And we get this idea from this word hevel, which you saw in the video, is how In the English translation of the Bible, it's described as meaningless. Life is meaningless. This author in Ecclesiastes says this over time. Life is meaningless. Here's what I discovered. Life is meaningless. And as you saw in the video, it doesn't mean a life without meaning, except it means that life is hard to understand. It's hard to understand the meaning of life. And let me give you a definition of this word here. If you kind of summarize it, you might come up with a phrase like this. Life is senselessly frustrating. It doesn't make sense. It's missing some sense. And it continues to be frustrating. And then this image is used here to describe what life is, that the author says life is like the smoke from a flame. If you extinguish a candle, you get some smoke, and it takes all kinds of really cool shapes, but it's always shifting. If you try to grab it, it slips through your fingers. Life can't be kind of nailed down and understood. It's not one shape, it's different shapes. But also life can be like a fog, and when you're in a fog, it's hard to have clarity. It's hard to understand what's next. It's hard to see what's coming. So you've got two illustrations of life as meaningless, which is defined as senselessly frustrating. You've got fog and you've got smoke or vapor. What else do you know about smoke and vapor? What else do you know about fog? It's there permanently? Of course not. It's only there temporarily. Life comes and life goes. It starts and it finishes. It's on and it's off. It begins and it ends. Life doesn't make sense for many of us, and nor can anyone really explain the senseless situations that sometimes life can bring. So in Ecclesiastes, we see three different realities. I'm just going to touch on these because we saw them already, but let me touch on that. Here's the three realities that Ecclesiastes kind of brings to the surface for us. Number one, time is passing. Time is passing. Circle the word passing there. If you've got notes, circle that. Time is passing. It's going by. It is rapidly moving past us. It doesn't stop and wait for us when we have to get off and then get back on. Last night, we sent our junior daughter, Jayla, to the junior prom. We didn't send her. We saw her off to the prom. And one of the things we said to her was, have fun, be safe. But you know what the adults say to us? Where'd the time go? You just look, oh, she's a junior in high school. Are you kidding me? Where has the time gone? My son, Caleb, every day does a height check with his parents, and he stands up next to us and he's checking to see how tall he is. And if you miss the kids for a few weeks and you catch up to them and you see how much they've grown, what do you say? Where'd the time go? How many of you notice that the longer you live, the faster time goes? I looked at somebody yesterday. We were standing in a group of people and I recognized somebody, and the first thing I recognized was, wow, that's old looking eyes right there. They're really wrinkly. I don't know that about you, but I happen to notice this about this person. Wrinkly eyes and a lot of gray right here. Wow, they're really aging. They're in my graduating high school class. They graduated the same year I graduated, and it looked like time had gotten away from them, but time's also getting away from me. And one of the things that we say on a regular basis is this: where did the time go? I can't get it back. How am I going to slow time down? Here's what the author of Ecclesiastes says: you're not going to slow time down. Time is going to keep right on going. It's going to trample right on over you, and you're going to be remembered no more. As much as you try to get a gravestone there in place for you to remember who you were, nobody's going to remember who you are. Why? Because you can't stop time. It's going to keep going, and it's going to go on without us. Eventually, the author says, we're all forgotten. Eventually, someone takes our place. The second reality is this, that death is certain. Real quick, what's the death rate of humans in America? What's the death rate? You guys are good. First service was like, they mumbled a little bit. You guys are spot on. 100%, everybody is going to die, no matter what. Listen, whether you're moral or immoral, whether you're wicked or innocent, you know what? Everybody finishes at the end the same location, death. Everybody dies. Here's how the author in Ecclesiastes puts it. Listen to this. None of us can hold back our spirit from departing. Can't do it. None of us has the power to prevent the day of our death. There is no escaping that obligation, that dark battle will arrive. Thirdly, life is unfair. Circle unfair. I hope you've circled three things. I hope you've circled passing. I hope you circle certain. And I hope you circle life is unfair. Circle the word unfair. Life is random in its nature. Here's how it's described in this book. The fastest runner doesn't always win the race. The strongest warrior doesn't always win the battle. The wise sometimes go hungry, and the skillful are not necessarily wealthy. And those who are educated don't always lead successful lives. And if you read closely, you'll see this. God's baseball team doesn't always win the World Series or even make the playoffs. It is all decided by chance, by being in the right place at the right time. Sometimes misfortune strikes good people, wise people. Sometimes fools are rewarded. We fail if we try to master our lives and control it. So here's what this book does. This book could be really dark. I mean, you feel it, right? It could be heavy and dark and hopeless, but it's not. It's not a book that says there's no hope. It's a book that says you can face death, you can face random chance, and here's what it ought to do. It ought to move you away from self-sufficiency, and it ought to urge you into the fear of God. Surrender, submission, and recognition that God holds all things in his hand. He eventually will sort things out. That when we trustingly place our lives in God's hands, that indeed is the proper response to a world full of absurdity and injustice and senselessness. This book is not meant to make us lose hope, but to show us that we cannot trust ourselves. We cannot rely on our own self-sufficiency. That we do not, yet God does, have control over death and time and randomness. We don't control that. God controls that. Instead of trusting ourselves or other human beings, we have to trust the one who created us. He's in control. And we're not. And this is where we come to the second part. Here in your notes, you can fill this in. What do we do? How do we respond? What does the book, the author here, the critic, tell us to do? Here's what he says. You should aim to enjoy your life, not to control it. Enjoy it. You can't control it. Here's how he describes it in chapter 6, verse 10. Everything has already been decided. It was known long ago what each person would be. So there's no use arguing with God about your destiny. In other words, you can't control your destiny. You can use wisdom to perhaps enhance your life, the journey to your destiny. But God holds all these things in his hand. And there's a few things that we can do to help us enjoy life. Number one, keep perspective. Stay in perspective. You are a human in the world. We taught this to my kids as soon as they were 2 years old. As soon as they could kind of respond to us, we started to teach them. There's a universe, and it doesn't revolve around you. You are a part of the universe, but you're a teeny tiny part of the universe. In fact, you're a teeny tiny part of our universe in our home. And we don't revolve around you. And this is something that as we age, we have to keep in perspective, right? We're not in the middle of our universe. We don't define truth for ourselves. We are subject to the truth. We're subject to reality that the universe, we're in the universe and we're not revolving around ourselves. Small part of it. Most of us are in the pursuit of building meaning in our lives. And we have poured our lives into building that meaning, whether it's through a career or a family or significance or what have you. And we're in the middle of pursuing purpose in our lives. But here, by keeping perspective, we recognize that apart from God, the things that we're investing have no lasting meaning. Apart from God defining it for us. Number two, release control. What this means is a part of keeping perspective and really a part of learning to enjoy life instead of controlling it is releasing control, being content with the life that you've been given and the life that may yet come. Learning to be content rather than devoting yourself to control. We really have little ability to control our own destiny because our lives primarily are determined by time and chance rather than skill or ability. Can you imagine that we don't teach people how to be defensive drivers to trees that are coming from behind us? Time, chance, random. Of course, that's an exception. Most of us, if you learn to live and drive wisely, you can extend your life instead of living recklessly. However, we don't ultimately have control over the outcomes of most events. And since we cannot control our lives, here's what I'm asking to consider. What if we just enjoyed who we have while we have them? What if we just enjoyed what we have while we have it? What if we recognize that who we have and what we have are gifts given to us by God, and our job is not to control our kids where we only enjoy them when they become who we want them to be? We can't wait until our spouses become the person we wish they were before we enjoy them now. Our stuff may not be at the level or status that we want them to, but the scriptures are teaching us to enjoy it while you have it rather than waiting for it to be something you don't yet have or belongs to someone else. Our jobs might not be what we imagined it would be and what we're trying to force it or make it to become. Here's what we're learning. Enjoy what you have while you have it. Because Lord knows how long we have anything, our stuff, our job, our kids, our spouses, our lives that we currently know and enjoy now. We can spend our time enjoying it rather than waiting for it to become what we wish it was. Number three, accept mystery. Accept mystery. We recognize that when you think about all of life and history, by the way, did you come across this story that that we now have a telescope that's stronger than the Hubble telescope? And this telescope, we're shooting up into space to use it from space, and here's what we're starting to recognize, that beyond all the galaxy that we're already aware of, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of galaxies beyond that. You've heard me say this probably many times. It's fascinating. These galaxies have billions already of stars in place and planets in place, and we have this little perspective. I mean, to call our perspective a sliver is kind of overstating it, right? We have this minutia of perspective, and we should work to embrace that this life that we have is a mystery. The breath that we breathe today is a mystery. The love that we exchange one for another, it's a total mystery. How this all has come to be and where this is all going called life is a total mystery. People cannot see the whole scope of God's work from the beginning to the end. We ought to resign ourselves to stop trying and enjoy it while we have it. Enjoy who we have while we have them. And the author in Ecclesiastes is saying, you know what I did? I finally just submitted to this idea. I'm not God. That's what I submitted to. I fear God, I reverence God, I should say I revere God, but I'm submitting to the mystery of God's timing and God's ways. Number four, lastly, remember your Creator. Remember your Creator. All of life's frustrations forces us into a deeper reliance on God. When I was in my five-hour safety course for driving. I still remember the Saturday morning. It was at Liverpool High School. I went with my partner in crime. Me and my buddy Scott were at the five-hour safety course, and it was the first time that I ever saw the risk of driving a car, no matter what speed, without your seatbelt on. If God convicts you today of not wearing your seatbelt, it's on him, not me. But I saw a video of low-impact collisions where someone didn't have a seatbelt on. I mean, they could have hyped it up, but I don't think they did. And it occurred to me that I needed, because of the risk, I needed a greater dependence on my seatbelt. And so now I wear my seatbelt, and I depend on it to help protect my life in low-impact, I should say, low-speed collisions. I depend on my seatbelt to control some of the unknowns. I remember that this is safe and secure. And here's what I'm asking you to consider. These frustrations, the senselessness, the actual senseless frustration of life, here's what it ought to do. It ought to shift us and move us to abandon our self-sufficiency in a greater trust and reliance that God has us secured. He knows what he's going to do and why he's going to do it. God himself is to be feared. He oversees all things, and eventually we trust that he'll make sense out of all of it. Ecclesiastes here recognizes that we're overwhelmed with information, that we're disappointed with life. We're anxious about what's going to happen next. But Ecclesiastes uses our doubt and our disappointment and certainly our discouragement or the uncertainty to point us towards a deeper reliance on the Creator who knows all things. Now remember, the greatest challenge that the author in Ecclesiastes describes to us is the challenge of death. That's the greatest fear, the greatest frustration, and the greatest enemy. And when you put your trust in Jesus, here's what we're expecting. Here's what happens. Because Jesus has been raised from the dead, he has overcome death himself. And when you are found in Christ by your faith, we too are released from the meaninglessness of getting stuck here in the grave. We're released from this old life that passes away, and we're invited in, we're welcomed into a new life of eternity where you and I, just based on our faith in the work of Christ, God releases us from the most meaningful part of life, which is it never matters and it's all there is. We get to hope in the life beyond. We get to hope in the restoration and the renewal and the reconciliation of all things at the end, and the most meaningless part of our existence, that it doesn't matter in the end. We cannot restrain our own soul. Our soul goes on for eternity and actually is raised and released from the grave. And all of the meaningless frustration of life, God saves us from the finality of death. And he provides answers for death. And now, in turn, as a response to that, we live a life of trust and obedience. We live a life where we enjoy everything that we have while we have it. We enjoy it as a gift from God. Here's how he describes, here's the conclusion in the end. Here's what the author says. There's a verse here that I want you to read along with me. That's the whole story. Here's my final conclusion. Here's my final conclusion. After all that senseless frustration, here's my final conclusion. Fear God. Live the way he expects us to live. Obey him. For this is everyone's duty. And when you know Jesus, it's not just a duty. It's a delight to do that. Because he knows, cares, and loves. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to spend our lives thanking God for what we have, enjoying all that he's given us while we have it, and let him control and care for and see everything else through. Let's pray together. Father,